I'm James Garrett. I'm currently a freelance executive producer working in TV, but also because I could never escape the lure of the print, I'm still writing the occasional bits of news stories here and there. I became a journalist in 1980. My first day in the job was the 1st of April, I think. Having done a postgraduate pre-entry journalism course in Cardiff, two things made me want to become a journalist. First was watching All the President's Men, a really gripping movie, and I thought, yeah, I fancy doing that. The other thing was during my, I think, last but one year at university, the then Labour government decided it was going to prosecute two journalists and a former soldier who'd worked for GCHQ for writing a couple of articles which revealed the existence to the wider world of GCHQ, an enormous intelligence gathering organisation which was costing the taxpayer millions and millions of pounds a year and which we were supposed to know nothing. The sense of outrage I felt about the government's decision to launch the ABC official secrets prosecution prompted me and not to vote Labour at the 1979 general election. It was that more than anything that made me feel that there was no way I could support Labour at the first election, general election, which I had a vote.
Okay, so where was your first job, and did you find it easy to get into the profession?
It wasn't easy at all. These days, being a graduate is the sort of first prerequisite. In those days, I had to face enormous opposition from editors all around the country who had left school at 16 and sort of worked their way up from T-boy or messenger and couldn't understand why I hadn't done the same. The sort of comments that I was getting at places like Wolverhampton and Sheffield was, if you were going to be any good as a journalist, you would have come to me with your O-levels at 16 and you would have, and I would have moulded you and turned you into a great journalist. As it is, you're coming to me age 21 or 22, whatever I was at the time. You've got a head full of liberal ideas and you're going to be no use to me. And there was enormous hostility. And indeed, when I finally got a job on the East Anglian Daily Times in Ipswich, that again, there were so many people with chips on their shoulders, it seemed to me, because I had a degree and they didn't. And quite what all that was about, I've no idea. But I mean, in the end, I proved myself to my colleagues, my editors and elsewhere through delivering good stories. And I think that's, if I hadn't been able to do that, then, it didn't matter whether I was a graduate or an A-level leaver or an O-level leaver. It was, I would obviously have been in the wrong profession. As it was, it struck me I was in exactly the right profession.
Okay, so how did you find those good stories? What is it you think that singled you out, in your own mind anyway, as to actually being a good journalist, despite the criticisms?
I think one of the prerequisites of being a good journalist is that you have to be a good listener. You need to listen to what people are telling you, and you need to be able to engage people in conversation, whether they are senior police officers or road sweepers. Either might have a good story to tell you, and indeed the road sweeper might know what it was that the chief constable was trying to prevent you from finding out, depending on obviously what the story was about. So knowing how to get on with people is really important. Being widely read, and being prepared to follow a hunch, I think, as well. Too often, journalists are lazy and don't follow up leads to see whether or not what on the face of it sounds like it might be a good story, even if it requires a lot of digging and hard work, is actually the truth or not. And I suppose that's what we should be aiming for, is telling the truth, even if it's hard work. And sometimes, of course, within the a journalist job, you need to have you need to be able to fail. You need to be able to pursue a lead based on a hunch that you have or on some information that you've been given, which sometimes sounds quite implausible, but nonetheless, if it were true, would be, you know, a very big story. And you need to be able to have the time to follow that lead, follow that hunch, and see where it goes. And sometimes it will be a red herring, sometimes it will be wishful thinking, sometimes the person that gave you the initial lead put two and two together and made five. These things happen, it's not the end of the world. You need to be able to recognise that, and importantly, editors need to be able to give their staff time to follow that lead, and sometimes it won't lead anywhere. And as long as you have over time your hit rate is better than your failure rate, then that seems to me that, you know, we should live with that.
So how did you go from East Anglia to ending up working here in Bristol? And make the transition from print journalism to broadcasting.
I spent 3 years on the East Anglian Daily Times, and I did my indentures, which we had to do in those days, sort of an apprenticeship. I spent 18 months in the district office in Felixstowe and 18 months in the head office newsroom. The editor for whom I was working made it very clear that he wasn't interested in me staying on the paper when I completed my indentures, because I was a union activist, and caused waves both for the paper and within the newsroom. And he, I suppose, was for a quiet life, really, and made it clear that I should consider moving on and getting more experience elsewhere.
Can you tell us a bit about that? What sort of issues you were dealing with at the paper there then, as a union activist?
The principal issue was poor pay, and an issue which at one stage prompted me to seriously consider leaving the profession at all. Back in 1980, I was earning, I think, about £4,000 a year, and 3 or 4 years later, when I was working on the Hereford Evening News, I was still not earning much more than that. Put that into context, contemporaries of mine at Bristol University who left to work as management trainees for companies, big multinationals like Mars, were getting £15,000 a year, so almost four times as much, with a company car, company pension scheme and all the rest of it. So there's no way I wanted to work for one of those companies, but I did think that it was reasonable that if you were doing an important job in the community, working for a local paper, you should be paid a decent wage. So I was quite a stroppy, militant union activist, and indeed was the father of the Union Chapel on the East Anglian Daily Times after I'd been there for about a year or 18 months or something, and was determined that, you know, that was part and parcel of the job, really. You couldn't separate out the working on behalf of your colleagues as a union activist with working on behalf of the community as a reporter. And I left, and I worked for another year on the Hereford Evening News. After 4 years, I was tempted to leave journalism, really, because the pay was so poor. But I got a lucky break and a job as a sub-editor and on the English language newsroom of the Swiss Broadcasting Corporation in Bern in Switzerland, where I was rewriting news agency copy for the Swiss Radio International Service, which is the Swiss equivalent of the BBC World Service. The job was pretty dull, but the pay was fantastic, and the opportunities for skiing and world travel made me sort of hang on in there. And then I did it for 2.5 years. It was actually a pretty boring job, and I was missing Britain, so I came back to Bristol, where I'd been a student, and started working as a journalist here. And I spent 10 years as a freelance, working for Venue Magazine, The Evening Post, national magazines, the BBC, and at one stage was working both for BBC West as a political reporter and ITV, or HTV as it was called then, as a consumer affairs reporter. And in the end was offered the job of a lifetime, really, by HTV as a reporter producer on the first series of West Eye View, and after and was editor of the programme from the second series onwards and until Christmas 2008.
What changes have you seen in the way that the industry works over those 30 or 40 years in it? Because you were talking about your union activism. So I would imagine that you've seen all sorts of issues arising in the workplace. I'd just like to know how you've seen the job of journalism generally in Britain has changed over that time.
It has, enormously. There are, in some ways, there are lots more opportunities now. The technology has allowed radio stations like this one to open up. You don't have to be the BBC anymore to provide a radio service or a television service. You don't have to be a big multinational. You can. So I suppose the means of delivery and dissemination of news has been democratized. But that's come at quite a heavy price. And it's harder and harder for young people to make a decent living in journalism these days, because although there are more opportunities to do the job, the reward has to be more than just it's a great job, I love doing it. You need to be, it's perfectly reasonable to receive a decent wage and a decent standard of living for doing the job. And my concern is that really bright young people are coming into an industry, whether it's newspapers, television, radio, wherever, who are having to put up with large periods of unemployment, in television particularly. The casualisation of the workforce is a big issue. As somebody who was a senior manager and editor at ITV, I can see the benefits to an employer of employing people for limited periods, for a few months at a time, to work on a particular series, rather than having people on staff who might be sitting around not doing very much not apparently doing very much for part of the year, and that's a real issue at a time when advertising revenue is going down and audiences are migrating away from terrestrial TV to digital broadcasters. Even big companies like ITV have to watch every penny they spend, and therefore it's better for them that people are, to employ people as freelancers on short-term contracts. But the downside of that for the individual is that they are likely to have to endure periods of unemployment to have a second job somewhere doing something else. The disadvantage for the broadcaster and and also for the viewer or the consumer of news is that you don't have the time that I was talking about earlier to fail, because if you've only got your production team together for a relatively short period to make a series of, say, 12 West Eye View programmes, you don't have the luxury of sending them off to just explore what looks like an interesting lead and then discover that actually there isn't a story there at all. You've got to go for the stories that you know are going to deliver you a half-hour television programme and not a sort of either nothing at all or kind of 10 minutes, but it doesn't go any further. So the risk there is that you can't spend the time doing long-term investigations. And sometimes investigations do take a long time because you need to gain people's trust, you need perhaps to film undercover, you need to gather the evidence that allows you to justify you filming undercover and so on. And that can all take a long time. And if you don't have a permanent production team, then it's very hard to justify spending the resources on long-term investigations. And the big problem for the nation is that the number of programmes that are able to do that, like Panorama or Dispatches on Channel 4, are getting fewer and fewer. And there are no programmes doing that in the regions anymore. ITV's West Eye View was the last one, and that finished last year. But sometimes the story isn't big enough to justify a Panorama commission. And half an hour of national airtime. But that doesn't mean that it wasn't really, really, really important to the people in the west of England or Bristol, for whom, you know, it was really important that that story was told. But, you know, there are now, those opportunities no longer exist.
You were working at HTV or ITV West, whatever you want to call it, during the transition from it being HTV to ITV. Can you tell us, you know, what you think about that? Because originally the whole vision of ITV was of small independent companies in different parts of the country. And now, of course, it's just one company that deals with Channel 3 for the whole country.
Yes. Now, I missed out on the sort of the Hollywood days at HTV, as the real veterans like to call them, when cameramen and directors were jetting off around the world making programs in exotic places and broadcasting them to the west of England. In those days, and we're basically talking about the 70s and 80s, particularly the 80s, having a Channel 3 television license in good times, economically, really was a license to print money. From the 1990s onwards, when, as a result of Mrs. Thatcher's dissatisfaction with the Death on the Rock programme that was made by Thames, the ITV franchisees had to bid to hang on to their licences. HTV felt it had to bid a ridiculous amount of money in order to hang on to its franchise. And something, I forget the exact figure, but 20-something million pounds had to be found each year on January the 1st. So before you even switched the lights on January the 1st, you had to hand over 20-something million pounds to the Treasury. And that knocked the stuffing out of the ITV companies, really. And the writing was on the wall more or less from then onwards, because suddenly ITV companies didn't have large amounts of money with which they could make costume dramas or expensive current affairs programs like West Eye View. Although we did, I think HTV / ITV West was unique in the end in running a serious half-hour investigative current affairs program of the ilk of World in Action and This Week. It was so that there was, from 1995, when I joined HTV, until I left Christmas 2008, it was a period of gradual decline. The first change was in 97, when HTV was taken over by United News and Media. And from then onwards, we were being taken over and cuts were being made pretty regularly. In 2000, for instance, we were owned by three companies in the space of about 6 weeks. United News and Media owned us 1 minute. They sold their ITV interests to Granada. At that time, competition law meant that Granada had to sell off one of the companies that it owned, that it had just bought. So they sold us to Carlton. It was a surreal period, and nobody knew quite what was going on for ages. So from 2000 until 2004-05, when the merger happened, that's to say the merger of Carlton's and Granada's interests to form ITV PLC, it was a period of continuing decline and cuts, with the regional output being reduced quite drastically. I was, aside from editing West Eye View, I was also the head of regional programmes and was responsible for commissioning all the non-news regional programming and managing the people that made it in-house and commissioning programmes from independents. And I inherited 5.5 hours a week of non-news programming, which was exactly the same amount as the news, which was also 5.5 hours a week. By the time I left, we were down to 1.5 hours a week, and it was about to decline still further to 30 minutes a week, at which point I just thought, you know, there are other things to do in life.
How did you find being a union member, and certainly in your earlier years, really a union activist? with being part of, I suppose, part of the management, really, of ITV West?
Yeah, I think traditionally what happens is that sort of you're a union member until you become an editor, and then it's and then you're sort of somehow made to feel that it's no longer appropriate to be a union member. And I never could never see the point of that, because I always remained, and indeed still remain, a member of the National Union of Journalists, and I couldn't see the understand the logic that said that you you couldn't remain a member of the union when you became an editor.
Did anybody actually formally say that to you or not?
No, nobody said, I mean, in television, I've always worked for good people. And nobody actually said to me, look, you can't be a union member. But certainly during the last year or two of my time at ITV, there was a... I think my membership of the NUJ became was sort of mentioned by other managers from around the regions. Couldn't quite understand what on earth I was still doing as a member of the union. And I said, look, you know, I'm no longer an active member of the union, because, you know, I can't be lobbying on the other side of the desk when I'm the person who's being lobbied. It's clearly bonkers. You can't do that. And I was a member of the management. But it was still important to me as an individual to remain a member of the union, because I've had my differences with the union at times over the years, over the sort of thrust of some policies. But it's always been important to me to signal that, you know, because I've always encouraged the people who, my colleagues, and even as a manager, I encourage the people who work for me to join the union. Because, you know, actually they needed it more than I did in those days. But in the end, I suppose, I felt it was important, you know, because, you know, there was going to come a time when ITV and I were going to part company. That was clear from the way things are going. And I thought, well, I would rather like to have the, you know, to be able to just step aside from the negotiations over the terms of my going and have the union do that for me. I mean, that's what it's there for, frankly. But it felt, you know, it felt particularly valuable to me because I wasn't, you know, it was going to be, it just took the awkwardness out of me talking to my immediate boss and my colleague, the sort of head of HR, about the terms of, you know, on which I was going to leave ITV. It just makes it less personal, really, I suppose, because it shouldn't be personal. It's just business.
To anyone coming into the profession, what would you say are the reasons for being part of a union? Do you think it's important or not at the early stage of your career?
In the early stages of your career, it's particularly important to be a member of the union, because you need other senior colleagues to give you advice. You shouldn't just take the word of your manager as gospel, because sometimes they will have all sorts of reasons for telling you stuff that are completely unrelated to your best interests. At a time, particularly now, when there's increasing casualisation, where wages are being driven down to the sort of levels that made me consider leaving the profession best part of 25 years ago, I think it's incredibly important that people organise and lobby collectively for better pay, better hours, shorter hours, time off to be with their families, and also to encourage newspaper, television, radio managements from the inside to continue doing the job that we're all supposed to be doing even when the economy is difficult, advertising revenues going south, and you know, and the government is increasing the number of laws that make it difficult for us to do our jobs. One of the things that is important is that people feel able to talk to each other. The places where I've been where unionisation has not been very strong have been quite... there's been quite a lot of suspicion of... and that can be... It's divisive and damaging if you're part of a team that's trying to, you know, work towards a common goal of producing a newspaper or a television programme. Quite divisive if... and therefore completely destructive to what everybody's trying to do if... There's suspicion about you know, what so and so's earning, and management make it sort of discourage you from talking about what people are earning. Actually, in a unionised workplace, people don't have a problem with explaining what they with saying what they earn, because generally you know, everybody knows more or less what they earn, because you know the pay grades are all available to be seen.
Okay, finally, can you just talk about one of your most memorable stories you've dealt with, and something that's really tested you?
Yeah, I had the awful responsibility and incredible good fortune of making a programme, which went out as an HTV West Eye View, and also as a Channel 4 Dispatches. Which led to the Bristol heart surgery scandal being stopped, and the three senior doctors who had been abusing the trust of their patients for so many years ending. And there had been, to my shame, I had was aware of some articles, a couple of articles, been published in Private Eye in the early 90s. Which suggested that there was a problem at Bristol. I didn't look into it. Somebody at the BBC did and made a programme which kind of told a bit of the story, but didn't get to the heart of the matter, really. As a result, the anaesthetist who had been blowing the whistle within the health service for ages came to HTV, and because it was looked like it was going to be a difficult story, it was given to me, and he and I built up a relationship over the next year, which resulted in this program going out, and immediately the Dispatches program had gone out on Channel 4, and the West Eye View had gone out on ITV. The General Medical Council announced it was setting up what at that stage was the biggest ever investigation into medical negligence, and it resulted in three doctors all being found guilty of serious professional misconduct, two of them being struck off the medical register, and the third never operating on children again. Now, I thought that was an amazing result, really, and that was, I suppose, that was what I went in television into journalism to do, was to change, have an impact on people's lives. And the impact I was not looking for particularly was to see people disgraced, but that was their problem, not mine. The impact was that the impact in Bristol was that children could, parents could with confidence take their children to be operated on, confident in the knowledge that that they would have a at least as good a chance of surviving their surgery here as anywhere else, and that senior doctors could not get away again with telling patients and their parents one thing when actually the opposite was true. And I think that the wider benefit of that program is that it helped people to realize that doctors who had been, I think, sort of we kind of put on a pedestal, can suffer the same failings as the rest of us, and that when it's perfectly all right to say to a doctor, okay, so you tell me that my child is needs a surgery and it's risky stuff. So how good are you? And are you the best person to do that job in this hospital? And how does your hospital compare with the national average? And you know, if and I want, you know, and I want, and I think it the program helped start a process of empowering people to feel confident about asking. So, are you good enough to do this operation on me or on my child? And if you're not, well, thanks for telling me that the operation's needed, but sounds like we need to go somewhere else to have that done. And I think that's a really powerful result of a program, which was incredibly difficult to make because, you know, it meant contacting people who had lost children and who clearly were never going to get over that, and discussing with them the possibility that perhaps their child need not have died. And that's obviously a really terrible thing for parents to come to terms with. So it was a very difficult program to make emotionally, but it was an incredibly important one to make. And I'm privileged to have been a part of the team that that brought that scandal to light.
For those that don't know that much about the Bristol Babies Hearts scandal, can you just describe what failings in the establishment that it exposed?
The failings in Bristol were so total that it's hard to believe that they had been allowed to carry on for so long. First of all, babies were being operated on by heart surgeons who weren't really sufficiently skilled to do the job. They were being operated on in facilities that were quite inappropriate. There was no specialist children's heart surgery facilities. The children and little babies were being operated on in adult facilities, and it wasn't until long after changes should have happened that that finally, you know, a dedicated children's heart surgeon came in and specialist facilities were provided. And now Bristol has as good as, if not a better, success rate for child heart surgery as anywhere else in the world. I think, but at the time, in the early 90s, that was absolutely not the case. And it hadn't been the case for a very long time. And what really angered me as an individual, you know, whose two children had been born in Bristol, was that within the health service, everybody knew that heart surgery in Bristol on children was absolutely crap. And if you were a doctor and your child needed a heart surgery, you would go a long way from Bristol to have that operation done. But we, the general public, were not in on that. And I think that was one of the scandals that, you know, it was well known within the health service that Bristol was rubbish. But, you know, individuals, members of the public, continue to take their children there, almost like lambs to the slaughter, really. You've got a head full of liberal ideas, and you're going to be fuck all use to me. Sorry.